Welcome to the Gifters Podcast. I'm your host, Christopher Kai. This podcast is sponsored by the GPS Online Program, which teaches you how to turn your story into a successful speaking and online coaching business. For more information, go to ChristopherKai.com. Okay. Our guest today is Thomas Pecora. He is a global leadership expert, critically acclaimed author, and former CIA officer. As a keynote speaker and strategic consultant, he has helped executives understand how to lead and communicate during times of crisis as well as calm, based on his 24 years experience as a CIA officer. It's all about human intelligence. He has served in protective operations, counterterrorism, and security training, where he's either a chief of security for several countries, or he's protected the president, vice president, and CIA personnel. And he's even worked in war zones, all of them across the world, during a 20-year span between 1993 and 2013. He's the author of Guardian, Life in the Crosshairs of the CIA's War on Terror. And his work at the CIA was also the inspiration for the feature film, The 13th Hour. Tom is a recipient of the Intelligence Star, one of the CIA's highest honors for valor. Literally, only a few dozen individuals have ever received this award, making it the rarest valor awards awarded by the U.S. government. Tom, welcome to our show.
Thank you, Christopher.
So, Tom, I don't know if you know this, but I was doing some research, and there are 48 astronauts that are active in NASA. And there's fewer Intelligence Star recipients like yourself than there are astronauts. So it just blew my mind in terms of the award you got. And you mentioned something about how, unfortunately, a lot of the people that get that award are those that have since passed.
Yes, they unfortunately receive a star that is chiseled into the wall in the CIA's entryway. And it's our Hall of Honor. And it's where we pay reverence to those who've lost their lives in pursuit of our mission.
That's crazy. So first, thank you for your service for our country. So talk to us. I'm curious. I'm always curious about the origin story. You know, people always ask me how I got started as an entrepreneur. And for me, I was literally a 7-year-old kid in New York City shoveling snow for my neighbors and getting paid $100. I'm like, wow, this is so cool. So for you, did you have any of those childhood memories that you can share with us about how this all began?
Absolutely. When I was in grade school, I really loved the crime stories on TV. And I got infatuated with the G-Men, the FBI. And at one point I heard that I could actually send away for an application from the FBI. So I asked my mom to help me write a letter, which I sent in to the FBI. And I received this huge manila envelope in the mail filled with information about the different career tracks within the FBI and all the things you could do there, including an application, which looking back, of course, they don't hire 7 or 8 year olds at the time. But I was, from that moment, I was hooked. And I wanted to be a federal agent. It wasn't until way later that I actually fulfilled that dream and ended up in the CIA.
And let's talk about that, right? Because a lot of people have dreams. All of us as kids, they do studies about how if you talk to a 5-year-old and ask them, hey, what do you want to do, Michelle or Michael? And they'll say, I want to be an astronaut. I want to be a president. I want to be a scientist or a teacher. But as soon as you get into school, all that, those dreams and inspirations go away. So for you, how did you go from a 7-year-old kid who had these great dreams of serving our country to actually doing it in time? So where was that transition for you?
Well, I kept the dream alive kind of with books I read and adventure movies. And I did the educational thing, went to college, went to grad school. But it wasn't until I saw an ad in the newspaper, my local newspaper, Milwaukee Journal, where they had an ad for the CIA. They didn't specifically say what position, but I said, wow, I'm gonna go for this. So I applied, and a couple months later, I got an interview, and months later, I ended up going to Washington, doing some tests, the dreaded polygraph, and I ended up in 1989 joining the CIA as a security professional.
And did you ask your mom for help that time when you applied for the CIA, like when you were 7?
No, she was just glad. She says, they're getting another good one.
That's great. And did you have any prior experience with relatives or friends or mentors that were part of the CIA or FBI?
Nobody in the federal government was working in my family. So this was a new experience for me, and I was moving out to DC where I didn't know anybody. So it was the beginning of a lot of adventures.
And I'm curious, I know you're probably being a bit modest, but CIA and getting in there, whether FBI, CIA, it's one of the highest and hardest things to get into. So what were some of the things during the application process that you felt that you were able to show them that, look, I am a strong patriot, I want to serve my country. Do you remember some things that they asked you that you're like, oh, that's interesting?
My background as a wrestler and then as a wrestling coach resonated with them because there's a level of tenacity, of discipline and perseverance that are required to reach the levels that I reached. I was a two-time national qualifier, Division I, and I wrestled some of the best wrestlers in the world. And that ability to persevere was something they were looking for. They wanted somebody with discipline, and they wanted somebody who was going to follow through. Very mission-oriented organization.
Yeah. See, you're an example, Tom. Steve Jobs once gave a speech at Stanford University many, many years ago. It talked about how things are connected, meaning you can't look forward and connect the dots. You have to look backwards and connect the dots. So in this case, literally, being a wrestler, I've never wrestled, but I've done some Brazilian jiu-jitsu, and it's like super real intense. You have to be very committed, but it's these qualities and skills that I know we'll talk a little bit more about for your clients in the corporate world, about how you've been able to apply your CIA, human intelligence, your leadership skills, your decision-making to the corporate world. Because just like in wrestling, people might think, well, what does wrestling have to do with CIA? It has everything to do with it in terms of the qualities, the tenacity, the strength, the focus you had then as a wrestler, then as a CIA agent. So I'm excited to share with our guests really how you apply your CIA strategies and leadership to help your clients make better decisions. But before we get into that whole human intelligence for corporations and your clients, let's talk about the book that you wrote last year called Guardian, a little bit about that.
Yeah, it's a biographical story of my career, but it's also, it tracks with the CIA's war on terror because they were working at the same time. And basically it was a baptism in fire for me. When I started in 89, terrorism was really not as big an issue, but it became huge, and it was a centerpiece in my whole career. And it was had a huge impact on the US government, and especially the CIA in terms of trying to protect the United States from foreign attackers. So the other reason why I wrote the book was it's the prequel to the story of the 13 Hours, the security team that was in Benghazi, Libya, that rescued the State Department employees in the consulate. And this is the prequel, the background story on how that unit was formed way back in 1990, and all the things that we were involved in up until 2012 when the Benghazi attack happened. And that was when we actually came out from behind the cloak. Prior to that, we were a clandestine unit, and we're not allowed to talk about it. And it was a very successful organization in terms of protecting our people.
So let's say a lot of executives, they want to build a core team. And they want to build this team to lead their company or their country. And in your case, you are literally leading teams in a very clandestine, top secret fashion. And just so our listeners to know that you span various eras of time, meaning the smartphone, iPhone, literally came out in 2007. And when you were involved with CIA, this is before Amazon. So what's crazy to know is that you were essentially there before the internet, before the smartphone, all through that. So I'm just very fascinated. What were some of the interesting facts that you found pre-internet and pre-iPhone to now 2013? By that point, was it a massive shift in how you went about doing your job and being a leader in terms of how you made decisions? So let's just start first with the beginning part, pre-internet and pre-iPhone. I'm curious, how did you even work back then?
Well, communications were much more reliant on old-fashioned systems, radios, and GPS, that term which everybody knows, they were just three letters in the alphabet. There was no such thing. So if you didn't have a paper map, you were lost. And in some of the areas we worked in, there were no maps. So you relied on your team, and their expertise on that team had to fill in all the gaps. You had to have somebody who was an expert at reading maps, another one that was working the compass and communications through other means, clandestine. We also utilized vehicles extensively. We had to have people who were, you know, well up on maintenance. So there were a variety of responsibilities we had. Gathering data was much more of a human thing. We had to deal with people. There wasn't Google. We couldn't Google the site. We had to go and do the research. And that meant we had to elicit information from humans, which they're still around and they're still useful.
Now let's talk about some of these connections, because literally everyone says they're in high pressure situations as a leader, but frankly, the decisions you make can be life or death. So how do you actually plan out some of these assignments where you go into a foreign country, you might not know the people there, and you literally have to protect lives? What are some of the first decisions you make when you're planning out this assignment? Because all of our leaders that are listening to this show have certain decisions to make, have a certain point, purpose, goal to achieve. But what's some of your first beginning things when you're planning out a mission or assignment for the people that you're trying to serve and protect?
The most important is the beginning, and that's the preparation. The Secret Service has a saying that the actual security at the event begins and will not be any better than the preparation done in advance. Mm-hmm. The advance agents are critical. They're the ones that have to gather the threat data. And especially when we're dealing with hostile areas, we have to have threat data. We have to understand the environment. We have to know what resources are available. And we have to plan to take advantage of all the resources or bring in whatever isn't available. So the preparation is critical, and the mindset of I have to gather data from the moment I start to get the information that I'm going to go to that location, and then all the way through until I leave the area. Threat management and risk mitigation are an ongoing, ever-present, living being that we must manage at all times. And that doesn't just apply to life-death situations or war zones. It's the lifeblood of any organization. Business continuity, and then you've got, of course, anything could happen with Mother Nature.
Yeah. And let's talk about business continuity. One of my clients, she's in that role, and I told her way back when. I used to work for American Express. I used to work at 7 World Trade Center, the third building that collapsed, and 40 Wall Street. But when I was at 7 World Trade Center, I was there in the late 97 to 2000, or 97 to 99. And I remember we would have weekly planning meetings, these disaster recovery meetings. And I, as a young, ignorant man in my 20s, I'm like, what a waste of time. Why are we doing these disaster recovery meetings every week in case something happened to the building itself? And so we have to take the operation and have an office in Weehawken, New Jersey. So at the time, in before 9/11, I'm like, what a waste of time. But when 9/11 happened and literally the building collapsed and imploded, they were able to shift all their operations to this offsite in New Jersey. My point being is we live in a world, whether it's a terrorist attack or a hurricane or civil unrest or pandemic, how do leaders have a sense of poise and calm? Because you have literally been in war zones all throughout the world. What do you encourage leaders to understand about their own mind that you have learned at the CIA to really just deal with these things? Because the enormity just seems so heavy. How do you deal with that as a human being?
Oh, that's an excellent question. It's really, really important. We have to understand that bad things do happen. And we have to get past the denial factor. The denial factor is the part that makes us freeze. Getting past that and understanding and truly believing that something could happen, whether it's a 3% chance or a 10% chance, we must operate from the principle that it could happen, it will happen. And what are some of the basic things we have to do to ensure our operations continue? Then we have to get that out to the workforce and help them understand that while this may not have happened before, it's something we need to work on. I was at CIA headquarters when we were attacked by a Pakistani terrorist. And this is months before the first attack on the World Trade Center. And that was such a wake-up call for us, because prior to that, nobody's ever at CIA headquarters. But from that moment on, we had a whole different mindset. And that's the critical part for a leader, starting with that mindset, it could happen. And I'm responsible for preparing for that potential.
Let's talk about mindset, because there's a woman named Dr. Carol Dweck. She studied mindset, literally spent decades studying mindset. And it came down to a fixed mindset where you're only fixed in what you know. You can't expand, you can't grow, you can't learn. And then the growth mindset is, well, you can learn, you can get better, you can think toward the future and perhaps mitigate some of the risks. So are there certain exercises you do? For instance, I have a former, I have a friend who's a former Navy SEAL sniper. And they talked about how they taught him how to breathe really calmly, because in these war zones that he would be fighting our enemies, he literally had to learn how to breathe and almost meditate. So in a day-to-day level, from a tactical and very step-by-step process, do you have any just life hacks that you can share with our leaders that are listening to just really deal with keeping their hair on their head and understanding that it is stressful? But do they teach you certain things about your mindset, or is it just more about practice? Because again, you've been in so many war zones, literally, not figuratively. Do you have a certain exercise you do every day or when you're in these various war zones?
The real trick is having a baseline skill level. And what I mean by that is learn some very, very basic things and get them down to where they're almost second nature and you can rely on them in a crisis. And that will give you that's your anchor in the middle of chaos. And you lock onto that. In terms of leadership, one of the key things that people get lost on is if they lose their way in terms of the mission. What is the mission? What is some super important things that they need to focus on? And for us at the CIA, we always focused on our people. And so in a crisis, the first step is, where are our people? How are our people? And from there, we work outward. But it's having that first step, knowing where to focus and being able to reach out and grab that. That helps get a level of calm. It's also very important if you were a mother and there's an incident in a mall and you have your children there, what you're thinking that exact same thought. And we, in the war zones, we sometimes jokingly say, it's like when you going to go out and play with your friends. Your mom says, where are you going? Who are you with? When are you going to be back? Those are the kind of questions that we look at, maybe more formally, but they're still as important in the corporate world as they are in the family.
Yeah. You know, Tom, your life is very indicative of what they've researched, meaning there's a guy named Daniel Pink, and he talks about the surprising truth that motivates us all. And the three things were autonomy, mastery, and purpose. So you are literally as autonomous as it gets in some of these places. You have this mastery of human intelligence, communication skills, and making those tough decisions. But the most important thing he said is purpose. I find so many leaders that if they don't have that clear purpose, that clear vision, or in your case, you're this guardian, this protector, it's hard for them to really lead forward. So let's dive a little bit more into this whole human intelligence. What do they teach you in the CIA to really connect better, whether to build a team, lead a team, maintain a team, encourage a team to really pursue that purpose? What are some of the basic elements of first, what is human intelligence? And what are some things you learn in human intelligence that allows us to connect with people?
Well, for us, we have a wide variety of people that we hire. So we've got this really eclectic group. And we specifically hire that way because people bring in very different skills and we make use of them. So we have to also react to that, which means we have to understand where they're coming from. One of the things that we started working on later in my career was more on personality assessments. And like the Myers-Briggs, the FIRO-B. And these are personality tests that help you understand what your tendencies are, what your strengths are, where your weaknesses are. And then they also teach you what other people's strengths and weaknesses are. So I'm more of an extrovert. So I learned that I work with people better and that helps me get the mission done. Where I have introverts that work for me, they need to acquire data differently. They need to be able to research, they need some time, and they need a certain way of approach. So when you learn that people have these different personality types, you learn to work with them at their strengths and minimize any of their, I wouldn't say weaknesses, but their less strengths.
Yeah, interesting. Now, All this stuff sounds great in theory, but in practice, when you literally are during these war zones, I mean, there's so many. I had a client of mine, he had 3,500 employees, and every single day there's problems. Someone's being accused of sexual harassment. This person doesn't have some of his papers correctly filed. One employee dies, and this is always these constant crises. So how do you go from having this crisis mindset where you're a firefighter always trying to put out fires, having more of this macro mindset? So you mentioned that planning is important, but when you're actually in the trenches, literally in your case, what are some of the ways that you're able to really maneuver and actively pivot and move forward? Because the word pivot is very common in the startup world and in businesses, where you always have to be on your feet. So I'm curious, as you plan this stuff out, you know about where these people are or how your people are, when you're actually in the situation and something bad happens, literally, what do you do during the things that when bad things happen? What's like the first thing you do when something that bad happens in when you're actually in the situation?
First is, and this works across the board, whether you're talking about a rocket attack on a camp or an accusation of sexual harassment or workplace violence, it's to gather data. Get as much data from the sources as you can. Always with the back of your mind thinking, the first report probably isn't accurate. And in many cases, it's not. We had many times in the war zones where we would hear an explosion and somebody would say, oh, there's a bombing attack going on and over there. And we'd find out later it was a controlled detonation of an IED, an improvised explosive device that the military had found. And nobody got hurt. But if you allow yourself to be taken away with the first reporting, you'll make some critical errors. Once you assess and gather as much data as possible, then you have to be ready to adapt. You have your set procedures, but you have to give yourself some latitude to employ other methods if necessary. People who are too rigid on their plans, they're not able to react to some of the strangeness that goes on. And having worked with people extensively, as part of my business, both good people and unfortunately bad people in security, we deal with it all. We have to learn how to work with the foibles that people have. People are making mistakes and we have to adjust to them. And the solution is not throw them out with the bathwater.
That's fascinating. I'm really curious about when you start gathering this data, not everyone's going to tell you the truth. And sometimes they don't want to even lie, but they're afraid. So what are some techniques or questions you've been asked to gather data you feel? Are you looking at certain micro expressions? You're looking at their body language? I'm curious in terms of the questions you might ask and how you're actually gathering the data, not just from what they're saying, but how they're saying it.
Well, that goes into one of my leadership principles, which is maintain a humble ego. And this goes across the board in so many different areas of leadership. But one of the things that worked really well for me, I used to do background investigations. I used to do investigations of theft and higher crimes. You want to be able to elicit information from people and get them to lower their guard and talk to you. Coming in with a large ego and pushing your way around is that's the worst way. I oftentimes would call them up and not tell them about what position I had. I would specifically just say, look, I need some help. This is the problem I'm trying to solve. What can you do for me? That takes away a lot of the onus. And instead of being a one-to-one conversation, it's two of us sitting together looking at a problem rather than one of us being the problem. And another aspect of that is I want to go to the lowest denominator. I want to go to the closest source. If there's a problem in a facility and it may involve physical security, it may involve personnel things. Some people have a little better feel for the facility than others. Those are usually the logistics people, the janitorial staff, or just the lowest ranked guard person. Those are the people that I gather some real data because they're there and their eyes are on target. So you want that real ground truth.
Yeah. It's fascinating you mentioned that, Tom, because one of my friends, his name is Chris Voss. He's the former chief kidnapping negotiator for the FBI. He was served in the FBI for 24 years. And he talked about how one of the single most important qualities is to listen, to be humble, to really get into these conversations with an open mind and open heart and really understand that it's a conversation, but what you're saying in the CIA or what he's saying in the FBI, and he's being able to parlay that negotiation skills into the corporate world where now he helps executives, helps companies understand how to negotiate. But essentially negotiation is exactly what you're saying. Understand the human intelligence, gather that information, don't always perhaps get the first take on the information, but ask some of those questions and ask as many people as possible, because frankly, sometimes CEOs see them up here, but the people that might know the most are the ones that, I won't even say down there, but like they're in the front line perhaps, right? So when you look at leaders, you wrote a book about Guardian. And I really believe you as a former CIA agent and now as a keynote speaker and she's a consultant, you really are a guardian, a protector, because every leader, they're protecting their team, they're protecting their business, they're protecting their organization or even their country. And so is there a guiding principle that you would encourage leaders to have when they are trying their best to lead their team, lead their organization and their country that allows them to just lead with a better mindset, even though there's so much chaos in the world?
Well, it goes back to, in my book, I talk about some of the leadership principles that really helped me succeed, both in the headquarters elements and in the war zones. And the number one thing that came out is maintain a humble ego and know yourself, create cross-cultural and cross-structural relationships. But to get that, it goes back to the first. You have to be open to listen. And one of the most effective ways to get through people's preconceptions and their disinclination to help is to ask for help, to honestly say, I have a problem that I need to solve and can you help me? And back in 2004, when I moved to Iraq, I was the head of security for all of our operations. Well, I was stuck with over 100 security personnel all across the country, protecting and serving a huge population. And I found myself overwhelmed with the amount of information that I had to gather, the amount of people I had to protect. It was when I realized that I had such a talented staff and that I could rely on them. So during our staff meetings, there was always a section where I would ask for help. I'd specifically say, tell me what we can do better. Most people were hesitant to say something, but the moment they told me anything, I wrote it down and we implemented it. If it was at all possible. Pretty soon I had every member of my team contributing and they kept coming back to the war zones because they felt a sense of ownership. They felt that they were being listened to. And I can tell you, our operations improved dramatically because all these people have immense levels of skill in areas that I don't, and I took advantage of it.
No, that's great. I mean, it's a perfect way to end our conversation here, Tom, because really leaders, the best leaders that are in the world, they listen, especially in the time frame we live in now with different generations, the millennials and Gen Z, they all want to be part of the conversation. So in the past, it's like, you do this, or otherwise you're gone. Whereas now it's like, you can tell people to do things, but the top-down approach really doesn't work anymore, especially with all the generations coming up. So perfect point to end with, which is if you want to be a better leader, you really need to listen better and have that understanding of human intelligence and human compassion to really lead that team to better times. So Tom, thank you so much for your time, your insights and your leadership strategies based on your 24 years of being a CIA officer. Thank you so much for being on our show today, Tom.
Thank you, Christopher.
Thank you for listening to the Gifters Podcast. If you want to learn how to turn your story into a successful speaking and online coaching business, go to christopherkai.com to learn more.